Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Yusuf Fakiri, who will be telling us a little bit about his efforts to get justice in memory of his brother. So tell me a little bit about Solomon's story. What happened with him?
Cam, could you repeat your question?
Certainly, yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about your brother's story and the injustices he faced?
Well, the story of Suleiman Fakiri is a story of a gross injustice in recent memory in Canadian history. Here was a man with a known mental illness who needed help, who needed care, and in the end, he's killed by the very same individuals who were supposed to take care of him. Suleiman was diagnosed with schizophrenia when he was 19 years old during his first year at university. He spoke three languages, Arabic, English, and Farsi. He was a man with many talents. He played rugby and football. In high school, he was born to the University of Waterloo's engineering program, and that's when he was diagnosed in his first year. Suleiman, the tragedy in all this is that the family tried their hardest to get to be able to support Suleiman when he was temporarily taken to custody at the Central East Correctional Center. Yet, in the four times that the family tried to see Suleiman, not once were we given permission or allowed to see him. And to this day, we have not been given a reason as to why we weren't able to see him.
So the prison was aware that he had a mental illness.
Yes, he was, because in addition to the fact that it was well-documented, I myself, with my younger brother, articulated to staff that Solomon had a mental illness. They were well aware of his mental illness.
And in spite of this, they didn't allow you the chance to even talk with him.
Not at all. We weren't able to talk to him at all in those 11 days.
So what ultimately ended up happening during this time?
Well, as we've seen in some of the media reports, his mental health deteriorated as the days progressed in those 11 days. And the one support system that he needed was his family. And he wasn't given that because the authorities did not allow us to give him that support system. And in the end, that's the tragedy with mental illness. It is ultimately life and death, if you have support or not. It took my family 11 years to keep Suleiman alive. It took the justice system 11 days for him to lose his life under their care.
So since then, you've started a social justice campaign. Can you tell me a little about that?
Yes. So the Justice for Sully campaign was co-founded by myself, a couple of others, to call for justice for what happened to Suleiman, but also, just as importantly, to make sure that another family does not go through this difficulty, through this tragedy. We don't want a tragedy like Suleiman, the way, that happened. Like, this is for Ashley Smith. This is for Justin Saint-Amour, a fellow who had a mental illness in the Ottawa jail. He ended up losing his life. Cass Geddes, another man with a mental illness. Edward Snowshoe, Moses Beaver, Matthew Hines, Abdurrahman, Hassan. These are people, you know, that we are also speaking out for, because we do not want another family to go through the pain and the heartache that my family is going through every day.
So, how has the community responded to your work?
I beg your pardon, sir?
So, what sort of reaction has the campaign gotten from the community?
You know, I'm humbled by the overwhelming support that we've got from the community, from, you know, across the country, and from different, you know, social justice folks in different areas in the field. But, you know, because I think people are supporting us because they get it. They get it. They get the fact that this needs to change. They get the fact that this has to stop. And people have been helping us in droves. They appreciate the fact that there are people that suffer like this and that are dying day and night, and they want to make sure that this does happen to someone else. So, and the campaign will continue to push for that. We'll continue to push for that because we do not want people in Canada, you know, our fellow Canadians, you know, with their loved ones to bury their child. We do not want another mother or father to bury their loved one. It's not right. It's not fair, especially individuals that are vulnerable. These are people that need help. They need support. They don't need to be killed. They don't need to be ruthlessly losing their lives.
So, if you could send any one message to the community about why the work you're doing matters, what would you say?
If I could give one message, it would be, you know, the story of Suleiman Fekeri is a story that is happening, and that should not be forgotten, so we can make sure that other loved ones, other Canadians who have, you know, loved ones suffering from mental illness, that they do not have the same tragedy. We want to make sure that we want to make sure that there isn't another Suleiman. What happened to my late brother should not happen to anyone. He's not coming back. He's gone. But what we can do, we can change, and what we can make sure is that someone else who is in those positions, their lives can be saved.
So, as I understand it, during his time in the prison system, he was waiting to see the psychiatrist.
I beg your pardon?
So, as I understand it, he was waiting to see a psychiatrist while in corrections, and there weren't adequate facilities. Do you have any thoughts as to what the prison should have on hand for people in his situation?
Well, the prison needs to have a proper and appropriate resources, you know, to support with people with mental illness. But people with mental illness should not be in prison to begin with. They need to be in hospitals. They need to be in facilities that have the appropriate training and treatment to be given to them. The caveat in the tragedy of my late brother as well is that my family made arrangements for him to be transferred to the Ontario Shores Centre for Mental Health. He was on his way, but he was waiting for a bed. That's the only reason he didn't go. He was just waiting for a bed.
So, what are the next steps in your work?
The next step is continuing to speak out, continuing to call for justice, to make sure that the new OPP investigation, you know, to make sure that the new, the investigation with the OPP that, you know, that the individuals that are responsible for my brother's death are held to account. We want to make sure people are held accountable with regards to what's happened to my brother. This is unacceptable. This is absolutely unacceptable and appalling what happened to a young man who needed help and instead loses his life in the very institution supposed to care for him. But we're gonna speak out, because, and we're gonna speak out not just for Suleiman, but like I said, for many other vulnerable Canadians that have suffered from mental illness.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely.
We'll hear a little bit more about the Justice for Sally campaign later in our show, but for now, we have a segment on the risks for those who would get involved with those suffering from addictions. We're going to hear from... Can you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Sunil Budai. I'm the manager of family programs and the lead therapist in family programs at Renison Treatment Center.
During our last interview, We talked about the risks for an addict who gets in a relationship. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the risks for the person who gets involved with the addict?
Yeah, so there are major risks for someone getting involved in a relationship with an addict who is either in active addiction or in early recovery. Those risks include disrupting the addict's process of recovery, and it also opens up risks for all kinds of abusive situations that a person may not be aware of, that an addict, an actively using addict, might use in order to get back to their substance or maintain their substance use. So the risks become very emotional, mental, and even sometimes physical for someone to get into a relationship with a person who is still in their active phase or just getting through to their early recovering phase.
I would imagine there's a lot of dishonesty on the part of the addict, especially when still using.
Yes, yeah. The actively using addicted person, like I mentioned before, will use any tactic necessary in order to get back to their substance. That is their primary motivation. So someone in a relationship with an addicted person who is not aware of that is going to be emotionally torn apart by an addicted person through a ton of dishonesty, and not only dishonesty, but the person close to the addict, the person closest to the addict, so someone in a primary relationship with them, they're the ones who are often made to feel like they're the reason why the addict is continuing to use their substance. So even in that aspect, it's really harmful emotionally and mentally for someone who is in a relationship with an addicted person.
So I'd imagine that in some cases, it's not a long-term prospect, as a person might get involved thinking, oh, I'm doing a good thing, I can be a savior to this person, and when that need wears off, and they finally recover.
Yeah, and well said by you. That's a great question. The fact is that many people do get into relationships with addicted people thinking that what that addicted person needs is just the right kind of love or the right kind of care, and that will help them to get over whatever the problem is, right? However, those are the exact type of people that an addicted person might seek out to be in a relationship with. The relationships, in many, many cases, actually don't end as quickly as one might think. In fact, a person getting into a relationship with an addicted person knowingly is usually the type of person who is willing to give up everything in order to save this person. And as such, they will take on as much abuse as can possibly be meted out before they recognize that maybe they might want to leave the relationship. The last thing they want to do is leave the relationship because that person, the addicted person, somehow fulfills a need in a person who is looking to get into that kind of relationship. The addicted person fulfills a need of keeping them occupied, busy, thinking about trying to save someone. All of those things are needs that some people have that they fulfill by trying, by getting into problematic relationships, not only for with addicts, but other types of personalities as well. We call that codependency.
Yes, but for the addict themselves, you got to remember, they're not in control. They're coming out of an addiction, it's got to be a chemical soup in the brain.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And in saying all of this, yeah, not necessarily blaming the addicted person for any of this. I mean, this is what they know, so and they feel that they need as well, right? So getting into a relationship might help them to get over their addiction. But a lot of the time, in fact, all of the time, they're not in control of their addiction. So not recognizing that, even in early recovery, they will continue to do what they need to do in order to get the substance, which is manipulate, lie, and steal, lots of different kinds of activities like that, right?
So would these addicts appear perfectly normal to someone who would get involved with them? They might not necessarily recognize that they're getting involved with a destructive personality type. And then,
yeah, I think what it really boils down to is the fact that a lot of people don't necessarily understand the depth of how an addiction takes someone's life. It takes someone's personality. It takes over their entire lives. So it's that that leads someone to get into a relationship with them. They might recognize that, you know, the person that they're seeing is someone who is, who, you know, enjoys drinking a little bit more than a person, anybody else that they know, right? But they might enjoy that about the person or think that that person doesn't necessarily have a problem until they get into the relationship with them, and then they recognize that that person is not able to really maintain the kind of relationship that they're looking for. And then they just do the work to try to get the person to become the person who they feel they can be. And that's where someone getting into a relationship with an addict gets stuck in this situation. They're constantly working to change the addict into the person they think they should be.
And from the standpoint of the addict, it can be very destructive, as we discussed before, that they sometimes need to be in a relationship, that can become their addiction.
Yeah, it can become their addiction, and it can also help them to get into a cycle that will get them back to their substance. So they might use the person that they're in the relationship with as a constant excuse as to why the addiction continues, right? Like, as in, the addicted person might say, you're the one who's causing me stress and making me drink, or you're the one who is putting too much pressure on me and I can't handle it, and all that kind of stuff. As the non-addicted person is trying to make the other person, the addicted person, better by trying to control their behavior and all of that, the addicted person might turn that around on them and say, you're putting too much pressure on me, and therefore that's why my addiction continues, right? So it's a no-win situation in many cases. Some addicted people, due to a relationship, find motivation to get themselves better. However, that's in a rare case, and that's when somebody is already at a place where they're willing to seek the help that they need in order to deal with their addiction, right? So I'm not saying that everyone who gets into a relationship with an addict is a sick person. I'm just saying that if you're going to get into a relationship with an addicted person, you have to be immensely self-aware in order to ensure that you do not get consumed by the addict and the addict's behavior.
Mike, so thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Great. Thank you.
Of course. Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
This is Moan Chan, 2 fourth-year nursing students, hosting No Scrubs on CGM 99.1.
Join us every Tuesday at noon and Wednesday at 4:30 as we explore various health-related topics and controversial issues in current events.
Remember, you can listen live online at www.cgm.ca. While you're at it, follow us on Facebook at CGM No Scrubs.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit about the Justice for Solly campaign and about addictions, risks, and relationships from Renaissance. This next segment of our show, we're going to hear a little bit more about Justice for Solly from Michelle Shelley. So what led you to be involved with the Justice for Sally campaign?
Hi, good morning, Cam. Yes, I actually had the pleasure of attending a presentation that Youssef Zakiri had given at the Islamic Center of the Islamic Institute of Toronto. And I was really moved by his presentation, and it's definitely something that's in line with my own personal research. And after I had left the presentation, I kind of did some research around Soleiman's story, and I reached out to Youssef and I asked if I could help in any way at all with the campaign.
And how have things progressed since then?
Since then, well, there's been a lot of new developments that have happened, definitely, with Soleiman's story. But in addition to that, there's been a lot of work that has gone on, a lot of grassroots activism. His brother Youssef is more than dedicated to this cause, and he takes his presentation everywhere and ensures that people are aware of his brother's story.
So, how do you feel about the story itself? What was your reaction in finding out that this man was allowed to die in the prison system simply because there weren't enough beds?
Yes, and I mean, I imagine like anybody that hears the story was quite, I was outraged, of course, but I also acknowledge that this is not specific to Soleiman. The situation is not unique. Youssef has been able to bring Soleiman's story out into the public to ensure that people are aware of what's happening in the prison system, in the correctional system. But of course, this is not unique to Soleiman, and I commend Youssef in his fight for justice, because this is not just about his brother. This is about many other Canadians who have been silent and who just don't have that platform to be able to use their voice to make people know what's happening.
So, are any changes to the current system coming into play? Is anything expected to get better for those who would be victims of this?
You know, Cam, all we can do is hope, I suppose, and we just keep pushing this message out there and ensuring that everybody is aware that we have a problem. I do believe, of course, that most people that work within the system are aware of this problem. I don't think this is new to them. But at the same time, I think it's really powerful and important that everybody, mainstream Canadian society, is also knowing what's happening, is also acknowledging what's going on. And hopefully in the future, this movement, the Justice for Soli campaign, is turning into a movement. And hopefully this movement is going to cause change in the system.
So, has the campaign seen any success so far that stands out for you?
Yeah, I think the success is that, I mean, that I'm having this conversation with you, that, the media has given the Justice for Soli campaign and Soliman's story itself a lot of attention. It's been in the newspapers. I know that there was a vigil held in Nova Scotia in memory of Soleiman a couple of days ago, and I think that just speaks volumes that this is an issue that's nationwide. It's not specific to Ontario's prison system. It's the entire country, and we need to pull together to work together to fix this problem.
So if you could send any one message to the community about what needs to happen, what might you say?
I think we just need to continue to use our voice, and people need to speak out against this injustice. We need to speak about human rights more in this country, and we need to understand that this is a vulnerable population, people with mental health issues, and we need to support people, and we need to fix the underlying issues that lead people to the criminal justice system as well. And I think that collectively, the more we use our voice, the stronger the message will be.
So, how has the campaign itself impacted your own research?
It's definitely impacted my research in the sense that I'm gaining more of an insight, I suppose, into the lives of family members who have loved ones who have gone through this struggle, I suppose. So that's been really insightful for me. It's been really insightful for me.
So what are the next steps for the movement?
I'm not really sure, to be quite honest with you. I know that we've got a lot more work to do. We need to change things in the system, and I think that collectively, the campaign is prepared to do that by any means necessary. So I think that the next steps are just planning to see what's next. I'd
like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay, thank you, Cam.
Of course. Michelle went on to summarize the whole truth of this situation in one very concise sentence, but a very telling one. Suleiman was more than just a bed at a facility somewhere. He was a person with friends, family, hopes, dreams, all his own. The truth is, there is a lot of work to be done, but we as a people must never shy away from this. If we just say the problems are too big and too intractable, we will never even attempt to break through those walls. Historically, where it comes from, someone taking the initiative, not leaving it to the next guy, not saying, oh, this problem is beyond my capacity to solve. It is about taking it into your hands and saying, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make this a better world. Simple truth, my friends, is we're all judged by the eyes of history. What we do today will shape tomorrow. What was once considered inconceivable can become commonplace. Things like equal rights, justice, opportunities created for people, not just those with disabilities, but for all people. Once you had to meet certain very strict criteria to be given any consideration at all. We look at that now when it's easy for us to say, what were they thinking? What ever allowed them to dehumanize someone to that point? Yeah, it's easy for us to do that now because some few brave souls decided to say, we can do better. The world can be better. Progress is inevitable. The truth is, when a tragedy happens, the only way it can really begin to change is by getting the word out there, by acknowledging, yes, this is a real problem. Now, how do we find a real solution? If you're someone with a story of disability life, write HandyLink 4, HandyLink, numeral 4, gmail.com. Always love to hear from you folks at home. The problems faced are very real, whether it be in an institutional setting or just the problem created in your own heart and mind when struggling with an addiction. Truth is, you must acknowledge there is a problem before you can look at how to overcome it. Now, in the interview on addictions, was discussed the problems for someone with that savior complex who may want to get involved with the addict, thinking they can turn them into this better person, assuming they even know the truth of the situation. Denial is easy to have when it's somebody you really care about. Denial may sometimes take hold. Oh, if we don't look upon the unpleasantness of the problem, it may just go away. Not so, my friends. I would argue that the key lies in understanding the world around us, the systems that make it run, and the people who make those systems run. Whether it be an addiction issue where you find yourself in denial that you're dating Mr. or Miss Mayhem and allowing yourself to be blinded, or if it's a matter of justice, of rights, don't let yourself be blind or ignorant to the truth. See beyond the obvious. Say, yes, this is the nature of the situation. How do I make it better? What can I do? Yeah, it might take a lot of unity among the people, but all you really need to change the world is a heart that wants to do the job. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.